Welcome to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Lisbeth Jacobs. Lisbeth was born Elizabeth Rivera Vasquez in Guatemala in 1976. She and her little sister came to the United States with her mother in 1988. They were fleeing for some of the same reasons that immigrants are fleeing today: Guatemala's authoritarian government and organized crime. But the roots of the story and the instability of the present-day Guatemala date back to 1954, when the United States, in the name of anti-communism and in defense of the corporate interests of the United Fruit Company, sponsored the overthrow of a democratically elected government of Jacobo Guzman. That coup resulted in a 36-year civil war in which over 200,000 civilians were killed or disappeared.
We came to the United States because my mother had an opportunity to come and study nursing. At the time, there was a nursing shortage, so she was able to secure a study visa with the understanding that she was going to go into the profession and actually make a contribution to the workforce in the United States.
Was she a nurse?
No, she was not a nurse. She was studying for being an agronomer. So she was studying to be an agronomical engineer. I'm not really sure what the term is, but just to work on improving and fine-tuning the processes for growing crops and co-ops and just trying to optimize the industry in Guatemala.
Well, what was going on in Guatemala at that time when your mother was deciding to change?
At the time, well, there was a period of great unrest. I think it had been going on since the 70s, since maybe the late 60s. And Rios Montt had taken power. And Rios Montt turned out to be basically a military dictator. He even banned women from wearing pants. He wanted them to wear skirts to work. So he was a dictator, basically. He was not seen as a dictator by other countries, but a military leader. And he basically installed a military dictatorship in the country. So if you can imagine, no pants, you know, for women, and you had to wear dresses and skirts. And that was just the beginning. And that was when my mother was pretty much in her maybe early 20s, going into the workforce. And obviously that wasn't something very practical. Her mother was a nurse and had to wear the whole getup that you think about with the skirt and the hat and everything else, which is, you know, now is not very practical when you see nurses in tennis shoes and, you know, kind of almost kind of a workout outfit.
Yeah,
it's physical.
It was a real costume then, wasn't it?
So I think she saw that. She saw her mom work really hard and just the lack of freedom for women and having no options. So there was that. There was the stigma of being separated from your husband, which my mom separated from my father. You were just supposed to you know, press on, and it didn't matter what was going on in your marriage, and you were just supposed to never get divorced. You know, the Catholic Church was also a very omnipresent. It was omnipresent on the lives of everyone.
Yeah.
And the priests or the big bishops were in basically collaborating with the government, basically subduing the masses and just telling them that that was their lot in life. And this is why people had so much faith. I mean, I'm not saying that people didn't have faith, because they didn't have faith innately and that they didn't believe in God and that their faith was not real. But I think they were highly manipulated into submission by the church.
So the rigidity of this dictator sort of served two purposes. It helped, at least the bishop saw it as a way to control the congregations.
And it solidified his place in the hierarchy, because he got to live very comfortably. And so he was fine. But the rest of the people, and that they call el pueblo, was nicely subdued into thinking that this was their lot. And basically the Job story was very popular, the suffering and losing everything, and yet God was somehow going to make it better at some point. So this is the what people lived by.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Lisbeth Jacobs. Lisbeth was born Lisbeth Rivera Vasquez in Guatemala amidst the 36-year civil war. But your mom wasn't going to have any of that. What describe your mother. What was her spirit?
My mother has always been a very strong woman. She had to take care of her brothers and sisters, five of them. And she was maybe 6 years old, and she was responsible for feeding them and doing their laundry and getting them to school and doing everything that a mom would do. And my grandfather was not present. He was off. I don't really know where he was off to. He didn't really provide. And so my grandmother had to do, I mean, she had to work. She was the nurse, and she had to work 12, 14-hour shifts, so she couldn't be there for her children. And it was basically my mother who had to take care of all her brothers and sisters, cut their hair, sometimes make them clothes. I think mom learned how to be very self-reliant from the get-go. And of course, once she started seeing the injustices, she was very much into, well, I have to get my children ahead. And it was also a practical, you know, she had to. And there was no way about not taking care of your children. So she entered the workforce. I mean, she started out as a secretary in the Ministry of Cooperatives. And she moved pretty quickly up the ladder. So she was a professional woman, and you know, she wanted to have all the things that, you know, you see like in the 9 to 5 movie with Dolly Parton and the clothing and the, you know, the success. But she also had two children to look out for. And it was a tough balance. But she always wanted to get ahead. My grandmother worked tirelessly so that each of her children could have land. So this was my grandmother's goal. She wanted to have she wanted to give each of her children a piece of land so that they could have their own houses and own their land. And she accomplished it.
Really? So all of the children ended up with a piece of land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To, you know, build their houses and just not be dependent upon the government, I suppose.
Well, and land made you somebody. Mm-hmm. You actually had a place and...
And at least, well, technically, you could say that no one could take it away, but that's not really true either. But yes, so also when mom was going to the university, I think that you can see it a lot like the 1960s here. There was a lot of activism. There were marches and protests against the government, the oppression that was going on. But at the same time, mom saw that a lot of these students started disappearing, and there were murders, women, students, young college students ended up being chopped up into little pieces, or basically they were never found and they disappeared. So my mom saw this very early, and she didn't see that there was no change happening as a result of all these protests and everything. I mean, it was a military dictatorship. They didn't have to respond to any pressure from the public. And she was pregnant with me. And she was asked to go tag or, you know, do signs for, you know, to post.
And so, you mean like tag, protest signs on the sides of buildings and such?
And normally they wouldn't do it in buildings, but I remember seeing them in bridges, and you would see them in places. And just to go protest something, lack of land, or you could say lack of education, you could say low wages, being everything was everything was on the table to protest and to fight for the right to do anything and move ahead.
Well, that's a courageous act to go protest a government that's disappearing people. I mean, she must have known, had stories of people who had disappeared. It's
yes.
One thing to protest a government that is unjust and corrupt, but if they're killing people, that's a whole another level that your mother knew about.
And she saw that, she saw the tear gas, she saw classmates being beat up. But then more importantly, they started disappearing. And one of her friends asked her to go, but for whatever reason, mom said, no, she was pregnant and she just decided not to go. And then her friend disappeared. She was murdered. So, I mean, to be so close to that and to see your classmates just disappeared from the face of the earth, mom decided that there was no way that she was going to raise her children in that kind of environment, even in a place where you couldn't do anything about it. So she basically started at that time. I mean, I was 0 years old. Yeah, still in her belly. And she decided that she was going to start figuring out a way to leave.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Lisbeth Jacobs. Lisbeth is talking about her mother and her mother's plan to escape the authoritarian government of Guatemala. So she started planning her escape early on.
Yes, and not just that, but she had an opportunity to go with the, Institute of Cooperatives.
Right.
She had an opportunity
there was
to go.
A way out.
Well, she went to Europe for 3 months. And she went to study about co-ops and they were very big in Europe at the time. I think I was 8, 9 years old when this happened. And so she saw another world of just the way that governments can help their people and the ways that governments can give people an opportunity to have commerce and lift themselves up and have a business that's actually viable. And that was what, as an agronomer or a soon-to-be agronomer, she saw that hope. But then you come back home and you realize that it's just a whole bunch of people. I mean, she went to the UN and she realized that it was just a whole bunch of people meeting in a nice place in, Geneva or Turin. I think she went to Turin, Italy, and they had all these conferences. But in reality, nothing really ever happened.
Huh. This dictator was just in the news. I mean, he's been a bad person for a long time.
It was well known that every time there was in the interior of the country, every time that the government actually took on a project like building basketball courts, basically underneath that basketball court was a mass grave. And this was a common thing that happened.
He was embraced by the United States government too, wasn't he? Or at least the U.S. government looked the other way, from what I understand.
So was Rios Montt, and so were any people from the 1950s on, because in the 1950s, one of the presidents, and I don't remember my history, but he wanted to give people land so that the, what they called the campesinos,
the farmers
could have their own piece of land so that they can produce corn or grow crops and feed themselves, but also find a way to sell them and have a market, just to give people a way out of poverty. And so this president at the time in the 1950s decided that he wanted to give people land. However, this was read as communism. I think, I don't know, maybe the intelligence agencies or whomever saw this as this country is going to go communist, and we can't have that so close to the United States. So I believe it was President Eisenhower at the time. He sent troops, and they were tanks, American tanks, rolling down our streets. And they unseated that president because they were afraid that our country was going to be communist. I mean, I think governments wanted to do anything in their power to make sure that that was the the Red Scare would not take hold of the Americas. So that's how everything started. And then those military leaders, and from then on, basically saw it as their job to maintain that and to, and again, basically 1% of the population, if you want to call them the elite, owned 99% of the land. And then that's how all their farmers basically lost their lands. I mean, they had to rent them. They had very little opportunity for commerce.
It opens the door for industrial agriculture too, doesn't it? I mean, the farmers don't own the land or run the land. Big corporations do.
I mean, when people say banana republics, I mean, you think about, I mean, who is it that came to Guatemala for the bananas? And basically it was a plantation.
Chiquita.
Yeah, Chiquita. And that's, and or we had gas. We had oil, and all our oil was taken as well. So basically logging industry, sugar cane. So there was a lot of that. And basically that never stayed in our country and never made our people prosperous.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Lisbeth Jacobs. Lisbeth was born in Guatemala amidst the 36-year civil war. She's just described the government of General Rios Montt, who was responsible for the disappearance or death of thousands of indigenous people and the squandering of the nation's resources. What about your dad? What was his story?
I don't know much about my father's early years. I know that one of my grandmother's husbands died of a heart attack. And I think he was well-to-do, so they were, again, set up maybe for middle class. And then when she married my father's father, so my grandfather, they were okay. I mean, they weren't, again, maybe just lower middle class. So my father, he went into the university and he became a veterinarian. So my father had already finished his bachelor's and was going into veterinary school when my mother and father got together. And of course she went to work to support him while he was doing getting his veterinary degree. And so he was there. But then I think mom did not want to be the wife at home. And they really never got along. I think they were pretty much cats and dogs anyway.
Well, your father was impacted by this dictator too.
Yeah, he got into a position where he, I think it was the meat industry and veterinarians, you know, just like in the United States, they have to certify that meat is healthy and that it comes from a good place. And I think one of his friends was approached by a crooked government person and was being pressured into signing something that wasn't, you know, good. Just for the sake of course, somebody else making money, just basically corrupt. And I don't know if his friend was pressured into it, but basically they were good friends. And I think he might have signed or he didn't sign. I don't know what happened, but his friend disappeared. And so my father was like, okay, well, I'm the next person because they work together. So he would be the next person to be approached and basically seen as, okay, now we're going to move on to him. And so he started feeling that pressure that he was next. And so I think my mother and father had only been separated for a year by then. And so my grandmother said, you have to leave. You have to go. I don't want to see you disappear or murdered. Or so my father left because he wouldn't cooperate with a corrupt government. For that, I mean, he's a pretty straightforward guy. But, you know, his story is the one where, you know, he came, he had a plane ticket, you know, he arrived via plane on a tourist visa. It's also very hard to get tourist visas in my country. It's hard to get any visa to come to the United States. You can't just come to the United States. Our government doesn't It's not like we have very free travel.
So did your father back then, he just said, hey, I'm going to go on, I've got this little trip, I'm going to the United States for a week or so and I'll be back?
And and obviously he is a doctor. You know, he was
a veterinarian.
Yeah,
right?
So no one thought that, you know, he would not come back. And so he didn't.
Although I'm sure he was worried about it. If he just lost a friend, his friend had been disappeared, he probably thought people were after him.
And they were. Yeah. I mean, he received phone calls and people were, you know, the cars that you see. I mean, this is kind of surreal, you know, the things that you see in movies, but they in fact happened. They just came short of threatening him, not to mention that he would call my mother. And of course, my mother wasn't very responsive because they were fighting. Because they were separated.
Right.
But he was also worried about us because he knew that they would get to us. You know, if you said no, then one social worker that I know ended up with her mother in a box in front of her house in pieces because she told them no. So it's not, you know, just about you, but I think he was also worried about what could happen to us.
Yeah, the people of the country get caught in the middle.
Yeah, you were either with the government, then you were a collaborator per se, or you were with the guerrillas, and then you were another kind of collaborator. So it was a hard place for people who just wanted to get ahead and feed their families and have a life. Just have a life, you know, and do what you do.
Your mom, when she left, they knew that she wasn't coming back? Or did they think that she was going to be trained? And
when worked here for a while, a certain amount of time. And, I mean, there was a nurse shortage. So they needed nurses. So it's almost like now you have the IT folks coming from India and other places where they're trained. And they're needed.
But Guatemala was all right with letting her go. They didn't see her as any kind of threat.
No, my mother was a professional. Obviously, she had been to Europe. She was, you know, working with that institute of cooperatives and everything else. So she didn't present
a problem.
Also, we were lucky enough to be sponsored by an American person, and he had to show that he had, I don't know, $500,000 in the bank to get us to come here. So he was basically our sponsor, and so that we would not be a burden.
So what was it like for you? Do you remember? You were what, 9 years?
I was 12.
That's a difficult time for, you know, you were preteen and you left the country that you knew. What was that like for you?
It was, I think the strange thing was that I didn't worry about leaving my friends. My mother asked us, do you want to stay here, live with your aunt or grandmother or, you know, and have your life as is and not be, you know, your life would not be disrupted. Or you can come with me. And of course, there was no choice. We were like, of course we want to be with you. You're my mother. And so I didn't really think about it that much. We left everything. I mean, we came with two suitcases each, and that was it. And so, but I didn't put a lot of thought into it. I just knew that I wanted to be with my mom and my sister, and that was it.
Could you speak English when you came?
I did not.
Did that cause problems for you? I mean, that's usually the barrier, you know, you get bullied in school. Was there any of that, or did you adjust pretty well?
No, I remember being made fun of in the bus when I was riding to school. I entered into the eighth grade, and I remembered people making fun of me, and the good thing is that I didn't understand enough to know what they were saying. I just know the way it was said and, you know, the laughter and that
people
kind
looking
of thing.
At you and yeah.
Well, I'm sure they called me names and things like that, but thankfully I didn't understand. And I remember being the kid that ate lunch by herself and, you know, just being, you know, that picture in the cafeteria eating lunch by yourself and nobody really cares that you're new or takes the time to talk to you. Obviously, it was a culture shock. Might as well be in another planet.
Lonely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Luckily, I was befriended. I was in ESL, and I was befriended by a girl who was from Israel, and she felt just as, you know, ostracized. So we were friends and took on a friendship. Unfortunately, she had to go back to Israel on the 9th. I think she went at the end of 8th grade. She had to go back to Israel. So that was my friend that I had for a little while. But, you know, ESL classes weren't very helpful at all. We weren't learning very much. And for some reason or another, I became a teacher's aide. I think because they figure, well, she's not adjusting well in class or something. But I remember being a teacher's aide for an English class. And that teacher saw my potential, and I was able to go to regular English. My transcript from eighth grade, I think I had like 98s and hundreds. I don't know how.
So you came to it pretty fast. I mean, nothing like being dropped into a whole different culture to motivate you, though, right?
Yeah, it was sink or swim. And my mother was doing the same thing, so we knew that we had to succeed.
That was Lisbeth Jacobs. For more on immigrant stories, please go to our website, immigrantstories.net.